I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Sean Eckford joins me now. The journalist and broadcaster was in town this past weekend to attend the Ma Murray Awards as a nominee for his work as a writer at the Coast Reporter, a community paper that has been serving the Sunshine Coast for over 20 years. Mr. Eckford joined the paper as a staff writer in February 2016, where he covers municipal affairs in Gibson's and the Sunshine Coast Regional District. He's also the host of the Coast Beat, which is their podcast. His career in journalism began in Ottawa, where he was a broadcaster on radio, including a decade at CBC Radio 1 in Ottawa, where he was a news editor slash reader for Ottawa Morning. He came back to the West Coast in 2006 when he became news director for Coast FM, spending nearly 10 years working in radio. Sean joins me today to talk about covering the news in his part of the world, the political issues there and in the wider world. We're talking a lot about pipelines and tanker traffic, and people on the Sunshine Coast are concerned, naturally. Just how much are they, and what's to come here in British Columbia when it comes to the extraction of resources? I'll also ask Mr. Eckford about his career in journalism and the larger issues surrounding its future. Sean is also a member of the board of the Sunshine Coast Festival of the Written Arts, one of the better literary festivals in the country. Visit coastreporter.net, and Sean's Twitter handle is at Sean Eckford. Please welcome to the Plant on Land program in person today, Sean Eckford. Mr. Eckford, good morning.
Joe, good to be here.
Thanks for coming in. Well, you didn't come in to do this, but you're here for other reasons. But
it's been on my calendar for a while, though, so I'm glad that we're finally getting a chance to sit down.
And I'm very pleased that we're meeting, because I've admired your work for a long time. Follow you on Twitter, obviously, and that podcast is doing well?
As well as can be expected for what we are. You know, yeah. Obviously, the Sunshine Coast is a small community, and we kind of like to think of ourselves as a weekly version of the New York Times Daily,
Yeah. Scaled
down appropriately for a community of 30,000 people. So, you know, within those parameters, I think we're doing well, and we're still feeling our way in a lot of aspects of making the podcast work. I had to convert a few print people into radio people and Yeah. Things like that. But, you know, the feedback we get is good, and we enjoy doing it.
I'm surprised at how many people listen to podcasts. Even though I've done this for nearly 15 years, I'm still surprised at in the last little bit just how huge it is. I mean, for a lot of people, it's their only – I mean, people don't listen to radio anymore. They listen to podcasts, even if they're just, you know, podcasts of radio shows.
Yeah, well, and, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, well, it was Serial that Yeah. Did it and things like that. But I think
– It's a little bit before that, I think, yeah.
And I think, too, what's really spurring it now is, again, it's – sort of an adjunct now to a lot of other journalism, like a lot of the podcasts that I follow for U.S. politics and stuff like that. It's, you know, 538, NPR, all Mm-hmm. Those people who were doing other journalism and realized that there's a lot of stuff you leave on the cutting room floor.
There's a lot of space online.
Yeah. And although something like The Daily, you know, Michael Barbaro keeps that time really tight. It's like a 20 minutes typically, Mm-hmm. But everywhere else you've got that room to let it flow. Mm-hmm. If a story needs 45 minutes to tell or whatever, you can take the 45 minutes, whereas you can't necessarily have 40 to 60 inches of newspaper copy and things. So, yeah, I smartphones, I guess.
It's hard carrying them around now. Yeah.
Trends are hard to figure out how they start, or at least for me, and I'm happy to ride the wave, but I can't explain how it happened.
But one of the great things when I listen to your podcast is that, because it's a part of the world that I obviously know about but haven't been. But, I mean, a lot of the issues that you folks are talking about or that concern you, as I mentioned in the introduction, pipelines and tanker traffic, this is stuff that we're all talking about. And I guess you guys have a front row seat to all these things, right?
A lot of it. And on the Sunshine Coast, too, we've been an NDP-held riding for a long time, and the politics have always leaned a little left
Right. Up
there, to, you know, despite having conservative MPs from time to time,
Yeah. Liberal
and Socred MLAs or what have you.
Yeah.
And environmentalism is a lot of it, and a lot of the people who've come to the Sunshine Coast to retire are people who've done things like been on the front lines in Clackwat Sound or you know, fought drilling in national parks in the States or even protested the Vietnam War. So we've got that, but we're also a resource economy town. I mean, it's almost as though in our little 30,000 people between Langdale and Earl's Cove up near Pender Harbor, we've got both the sort of urban economy and urban outlook that you have in Vancouver with also a resource extraction economy. The pulp mill is still our biggest employer. There's a lot of logging. There's a big new gravel extraction project, Burnco Aggregates on Howe Sound, that's been a little controversial, but again, it's a big part of the economy. We've got another aggregate mine right in downtown Sechelt. So it gives you that interesting mix on these issues, because you have people who've got experience from all across the country in thinking and talking about them, and also this unique mix of we're still partially that rural resource economy, yet at the same time, we're quite urban.
And so for you as a reporter, I mean, that must be great to cover, especially in these times, these political times. I mean, you realize, I said a moment ago, really at the fore of all of this.
Oh, for sure. And it's funny how it coalesces there too. Our local governments, for instance, are often very active on going to Union of BC municipalities or the Vancouver Island municipalities and bringing forward motions on things like tankers and what have you. But it's also, you know, when I first came back in 2006 to head up the news department at Coast FM, I thought, you know, I'm going to be lucky if I get one or two good local stories a week. And I'll just have to fill with a lot of stuff from Canadian press.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were doing three or four decent local stories a day. And, you know, quite a bit of it was that conflict. It's when you talk about the tankers and the pipelines, you know, we're going to be sort of on the front line of LNG if wood fiber goes through. But oddly enough, when, you know, you look at the little dotted line of where the Kinder Morgan tankers will go, they're actually not really, you know, they're going to bypass us because they're going to hit Point Grey and turn left and, you know, out through Juan de Fuca Strait or down into Puget Sound. But people are very conscious of, you know, looking out at that body of water at the Salish Sea and saying, geez, if anything happens to that, we're sunk.
Yeah.
And I think that's the real concern, too.
So is it then, I hate to put it this way, but is there a lot of hysteria, do you think, in terms of how people are talking about these issues? Not necessarily the media, but a lot of the activists, especially on both sides.
I think, and, you know, that's true of almost anything now.
Any issue.
The two ends of any issue are so extreme. We had, on our podcast, we were talking about some of the general issues related to the pipeline expansion and whatnot. And you look right now at the tanker traffic and the heavy ship traffic that is moving through Georgia Strait. And the fact that there hasn't been an accident of some sort yet has been pretty amazing. We've gotten really lucky. And statistically, something bad is bound to happen.
Yeah,
it always does. So I think there is the number of, you know, the sevenfold increase is really, you know, the sevenfold increase in ships from one terminal. It's not sevenfold on the whole traffic. But you can see that people have this legitimate concern that something bad will happen. I know a lot of people, though, and quite a few on the Sunshine Coast have been, you know, they commute back and forth to places like Fort Mac, and they work in that industry. And when tough times come to that industry, it does hit all of Canada. Is it doom and gloom? Will Alberta cease to exist, as Jason Kenney fears? Probably not. But, you know, there's an argument to be made that you got to do something with that stuff.
So it's not only a beautiful place to live and work. I mean, there are obviously these tensions, aren't there? I mean, we tend to think, living down here in Vancouver, that people up there speak with one voice, if you will. You know what I mean?
And I can see how you would think that, because there's not many of us.
Yeah.
But no, it is a lot of different perspectives, and I don't want to exaggerate the tension. But, you know, obviously that's our stock and trade in the news business that that fuels a lot of the stories.
Yeah.
And in a way, we do speak with a unified voice on how much we choose to live there and the reasons we do it. And that's regardless. I mean, you know, some of my friends and neighbors who do work in the oil patch, you know, also really are interested in preserving that spot of the world where they live on the Sunshine Coast.
Yeah.
And, you know, they draw oil from the ground as a way to make the money to be able to live that lifestyle. But it's a microcosm of things. But because it's so close to the city,
yeah,
even without building a bridge, we've got, you know, the influence is the same. We've all, you know, the ties are really close to places like North and West Van. A lot of people have family there and stuff like that. So it is like any place in terms of the difference in attitude. But yet again, it's unlike any other place in that we're a little isolated pocket and we kind of like it that way.
Well, what else? What are some of the things like in the last week or so that you've been covering that are of concern to people on the Sunshine Coast?
There's the same concern about real estate that we have in Vancouver, because it's a bit of a knock-on effect. We are not one of the areas that's subject right now to the speculation or the foreign buyer's tax, but we have seen our property values go up, and a lot of the older people on the Sunshine Coast are retired, so they have a fixed income. Property taxes are a concern as property values creep up, and again, big development. People worry about that. A lot of the stories we write are around the prospect of, you know, 600, 700 home developments going in. And that all also is framed around the other big, big issue we have. And this week's podcast, we focus on it, is there's a real water issue right now on the Sunshine Coast. We don't have a large reservoir system. We draw most of our water from a couple of lakes in a provincial park on the high ground up above Seashelt. And we have had, and it made news in Vancouver, a couple of late season droughts. I mean, we couldn't put ice in one of our rinks because we didn't have enough water. Really? So there's a whole debate right now about where we're going to find the water, how we're going to pay for what we need to do to establish a proper reservoir that can get us through, because we've got the rainfall, we've got the creeks flowing in the winter. If we can store the water, then we're fine. But all of this is complicated by the fact that our source is located within a provincial park, and there's only so much the BC Environment Ministry is going to let you do when it comes to damming or draining lakes in a provincial park. So that I think is the development pressure, and what's happening with our water are the two big local issues right now. And we're expecting that's going to drive the election a little bit too.
The municipal election in the fall.
Yeah.
Now, so this begs a question as to was there no forethought years ago that this part of the world was going to grow in terms of the number of people that it was going to house?
This is the key question that a lot of people are asking themselves. And the regional district we have, sort of our version of Metro, they were formed in part because back then, 50 years ago, there was the need for a municipal water system. A lot of us in some areas are, like, for instance, my house, I draw water from a well. And most of my neighbors do, because we're nowhere near where the municipal water pipes run. So I think there was this combination of not realizing how many people would eventually need to be hooked to that system, as opposed to living in places where they could sink their own well. And a thought that it could be kept to a minimum. Restricting growth has been part of, and again, when we talk about the tension of development, up there has been for a while an attitude that we're small and we want to stay small. So a big growing population didn't really show up on a lot of people's radars, because they deliberately wanted that not to happen. And it has, and it turns out too, with just climatic conditions, we didn't used to get the same sort of droughts at the same severity at the times of year we're getting them now. Like, typically when we're on full water restrictions, when it's had to happen, it's been September, October. It's just that last little bit before the rains start.
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened up to now. So it's a combination.
So livability really is something that a lot of us are talking about, regardless of where we live. And I guess we're at a point now where, certainly in Vancouver, where, and I keep hearing this all the time, so I'm skeptical naturally, that we're at a tipping point that it's going to get worse very soon. But, I mean, I've been hearing that for the last 10 years or so. Is there a danger of, up where you live, of, say, the way of life, they're changing a great deal where it'll be unrecognizable, say, 5 years down the line?
I don't know if I want to call it a danger, because I don't think it is, but right. There are aspects of it.
There are people that will say that, it, you know, the yeah. horde of people coming in will you know, screw this place up, right?
And I don't think it will, because yeah. those people will still be people who are looking for the type of lifestyle you can have on the Sunshine Coast.
Right.
You know, 5 minutes to drop your kayak in.
Yeah, they're not looking to build, say, skyscrapers or anything.
No, right? But yeah. the funny thing is, you know, when I say an aspect of it does have to change,
yeah.
we have a really bad rental situation up there right now. If you wanted to move to the Sunshine Coast, and this has happened in our community to people who are doctors and lawyers and yeah. you know, fairly well-off professionals who could afford to rent, can't there is actually no physical building. And so, you know, it's hoped actually that some of the new development coming on will be a better housing mix. It's you know, it's like the discussion you get in Vancouver and places like Dunbar and Point Grey or whatever, where it's, well, it's all single family homes. We can't run a city like this.
Yeah.
Well, we have that on the Sunshine Coast. I can think of two dedicated rental apartment buildings in Gibson's, and there's perhaps 40 to 50 units among them.
Yeah.
So that is going to have to change, because we're going to need our community to get younger, you know, young families, professionals, people who work in the service industry. We're going to need them up there. And right now there's no housing for them. So even if they can get a job, they can't live. So that's a tough balance. You got that part of your lifestyle needs to change up there. The communities need to change. We need to pick areas where we can urbanize a little more, yet at the same time, protect the rural feel.
It's a terrible balance that, well, I don't envy politicians that have to sort of, you know, weigh that, right?
I don't envy developers or real estate agents who have to weigh it either. But
yeah. You grew up in Vancouver, though, right?
No, actually, I grew up on the Sunshine Coast.
Oh, I see.
I don't want to say we bounced around a lot, but I did complete high school in Vancouver. So at that time, for, you know, grades, what, 10 through 12, so that's 3 years, I lived here while I was at school. But we grew up on the Sunshine Coast, and yeah. I live now, you know, about a kilometer and a half from my family home. My parents still live up there, and I've had a lot of generations of my family on the Sunshine Coast from both sides. But
yeah, I guess here's the thing. I sort of know of you because I watched your brother for years on television, and he would talk about growing up and things like that.
Yeah.
So I did figure, Mike did mention from time to time that he grew up sort of in the bush, which I guess is the Sunshine Coast.
And it was really in the yeah. bush when we were kids. It's yeah. it's a lot more. We have neighbors now. We didn't used to.
and not animals too, right? Not
oh,
people neighbors.
Yeah.
But I guess you both went to St. George, is that right?
Yeah, and I'm not. Nowadays, I'm uncertain whether that's a good thing to admit or not, because like everything, the school has changed a lot from how it was when we graduated. But yes, we're both both Georgians,
yeah.
as they call graduates.
So I guess in those high school years, you all lived here, is that right?
Yeah, we were boarding students, and we yeah. had family
on
the North Shore and stuff like that. And it was, again, it was at the time where the Sunshine Coast was just getting to the point where it was big enough that the high school programs there were just starting to evolve to be a lot more heavily academic. And,
yeah.
you know, a lot of us who lived there at the time, who had our eyes on a university career, if we could, chose an independent school to finish up at. To kind of give us that edge to get into universities. But now, you know, the level of academics at the two high schools on the Sunshine Coast is incredible. I'd easily, happily graduate from one of them if I had to do it again.
Yeah. So you went to Queens.
Mm-hmm.
And then you finished school there. And then was that where you began your career in journalism?
Sort of. Yeah. I ended up, I don't want to say that I'm completely an accidental journalist, but I had my sights on sort of broadcasting in a general sense. So I started my radio career in Kingston, you know, through campus radio, and then at one of the commercial stations while I was finishing school. And you know, as a historian, which was what my academic background is, I was already pretty well trained to do the sorts of things a journalist does. The, you know, it's research, it's analysis, it's presentation of the finished product. It's all the same skill set. And I just happened to find a job opening in a newsroom after one of the program directors I worked for said, you know, you're not quite cut out to be a DJ. I think your place is in news and you should give that a shot. And I did, and it kind of went from there.
Yeah. So you ended up at the CBC for a decade.
Yep.
And then you came out here again in radio.
Yep.
This again,
little bits of print freelance in between, of course, but it was mostly broadcast focused because that's really what I wanted.
And so I guess, did people ask you at the time why you chose journalism?
I don't know that they asked it in quite that way. You know, people always wanted to know the story. And again, people in Vancouver will be used to, my brother and I used to laugh because whenever he would visit in Ontario, I was the famous Eckford. He was just the guy's brother. I come out here and I'm just the brother of the famous Eckford.
Yeah.
And what people used to ask us mostly is how we both ended up in the same business,
right,
as opposed to why we chose it. But I do get asked a little bit why journalism. And again, it's just because in some ways it was actually the path of least resistance. It fitted the skills I had and the opportunities were there.
It's better than digging like septic tanks and things like that, right?
Yeah. Although I have done that and a little physical labor is fun, but I'm not built for that either in the long run. So it was good.
So I guess I'm asking why journalism is because you've evolved into someone who online that people know as a journalist and regard highly because of certain events that have happened in your career, right?
That's a very delicate way of putting it.
Yeah, and I mentioned the what was it 3-4 years ago now. Coast FM?
Yeah, late 2015.
Yeah, so you
had my rupture with my employers.
You were there for about nearly 10 years.
Yep.
News director at Coast FM, and then I guess the station out in Nanaimo, is that right?
We were actually a single station that served both markets the geographic fluke of having our transmitter on Mount Benson.
Right.
Turned out we had a very good signal in Nanaimo, so the owners thought a good way to expand the audience would be to have a studio in Nanaimo, sell some ads there and things like that. And after our company was bought by Vista Radio, we'd been an independent for most of my time there. And when Vista bought it, I also eventually ended up overseeing the newsroom at their station in Duncan on Vancouver Island.
So you made news when the company that owned the station wanted it's journalists to do more than just journalism. And you were lauded for the principled stand that you took in that. The fallout from that, I mean, you obviously had to leave the job that you liked. I'm assuming you liked.
Don't get me wrong. I love doing radio news. Yeah. And it was fun to be, in particular, it was fun to be a small market news director. I enjoyed that work, but the thing about that, and again, I still fundamentally disagree with the direction the management of that company has taken its news service everywhere it operates now.
Right.
But also, it was this notion of, and it wasn't meant to be a permanent thing, but having people in the newsroom, reporters, participate in advertising sales. And I was aghast at two things about that. One was that I was never approached in advance and asked, well, as news director, do you think this is okay? Obviously, I would have said no. And when I got wind of it and I tried to get the policy reversed, there were no takers for my side of the opinion, as it were. And I thought the only thing I can do is I can't head up a news department where something like this is allowed to happen. I've got to leave. I did not expect at all that anyone would much know. Mm. It had been discussed privately with our colleagues. I think it's no secret to anybody that we have a Facebook group where journalists around the Lower Mainland, we congregate, we trade secrets and gossip. And I had talked about my situation in that forum. Mm-hmm. And from there, it got to JSource, which is one of the trade papers mm-hmm. For journalism. And I thought, well, okay, I can see how they'd be interested. Did a little interview with them. They did a story after I left. And suddenly I'm getting calls from people like As It Happens. And I'm still surprised that there was that much interest in what really was a dispute with my managers.
Yeah.
But on reflection, I think it shows that at the time, there was a real concern for the future of journalism in the general public. Mm-hmm. This is what, I did the one thing I hate. When I was the subject of a story, a producer would call me and I would say, there's no story here. Why are you interested in talking to me? And what they said was, look, our audience is actually really worried, we think, about how our whole business is going.
Yeah.
So anything like that is worth talking about. And, hopefully I acquitted myself well and made my argument. The company's policy, I don't think, ever changed.
No.
I don't really know what they do now. But so in that way, the only person really harmed was myself. Vista Radio hums along and makes whatever profit it makes now, and that's about it.
That's why I have journalists like you on, and that's why I invited you on today, is because a lot of people that I talk to who are voters, who are media consumers, are always interested in how the media business works and how journalism works. And we're living in a time, and I guess it began around the time that this all happened with you. People are concerned, aren't they, about the future of journalism, and they're concerned with how it works or what it should be.
And I think, too, there is that concern because this is the product that people see.
Mm-hmm.
Internally, I think the concern is more, how do you resource that? And, part of the discussion I had with my managers at Vista was, frankly, they were of the opinion that really the news department doesn't do anything for us. It doesn't carry its weight in terms of bringing in money.
Mm.
And I've started to... One of the reasons I enjoyed being a small market news director is you can make a difference in that situation. And, I've always believed that news is the gateway drug, especially in radio. And in a small town, you could have whatever music format you want, country or whatever. People are going to tune into the newscast because you're the only person talking about what's going on in their town hall.
Mm.
And there seems to be no longer an appreciation for that sort of thing or no understanding of how you can make money at it. And I don't have all the answers for that, but I think that's part of where the concerns come. People have finally started to see the cuts that have gone on in the industry really since about the mid-90s are now starting to reflect in the product. People are seeing fewer bylines. You open the paper, there aren't as many names mm-hmm. in it. And people are starting to wonder what the impact is on the coverage. But you know what? Everybody who still has a job in journalism is doing their damnedest to give you the best coverage they can. And I don't think, from that perspective, we're maybe getting less of the product, but we're still getting good product when we get it, I hope.
Do you think because of events in the wider world, especially in the United States, that the journalism is going through some sort of renaissance, if you will?
I'd like to think so, and that's almost a good way to put it, because it is kind of a rebirth, because we're really thinking more about how we do it. There's one of the I was talking actually just last night with Penny Daflos of CTV,
yeah.
who started doing a podcast for CTV where she's trying mm-hmm. to take people behind the scenes. And there is a movement that started a bit in the States, obviously, where journalists became public enemy number one for a certain presidential candidate who now is president.
Yeah.
But we're trying now to do more to show our work, like to bring people inside and say, all right, here's the story you read, those 500 words or 30 seconds on the radio. here's how we got there, why we made the decisions we made. And I think for a while, journalists weren't willing to talk about that. It was sort of trade secret stuff, yeah, yeah. Or we thought it was boring insider baseball. But now I think that's the rebirth you're seeing, is you're going to get a lot more explanation of how the finished journalism happened. And, it's through things like podcasts or blogs and stuff, where we can take you a little bit inside why we made the decisions we made. And I think I'm seeing evidence that that's becoming a bit of a renaissance.
Well, what I'm finding fascinating is when these long form pieces of journalism come out, they drop one afternoon. The next morning, there's equally long pieces about how the story came together, either by, like the J Source types and the Columbia Review,
sure,
of journalism. But we'll put out these things. They'll interview the reporters about how the work or the podcast that the outlet has. And I think that's much better for the consumer. So in our part of the world, Sean, do you think we're well served by the journalists we have?
I have to say yes. I know most of them,
yeah.
But that's also why I can say yes. I think we're as well served as the journalists can serve us. Would I love to see newsrooms with more resources? Heck yes. There was a time, one of my former bosses, one of the founders of the radio station on the Sunshine Coast, who started as an independent, had worked in the news department at CFUN.
Mm.
And a rock and roll station with an award-winning news department was a thing back then.
Right.
It's not anymore. If you do get the news on your rock outlet, it's a 30-second pre-recorded bite from whatever your news talk outlet is.
Yeah.
I'd love to see more players in the game. I'm absolutely heartbroken about what's happening at Roundhouse, because I still carry on my iPad their original prospectus from when they were getting their license, because I was so impressed with what I thought they were going to do.
Yeah.
And I thought that was maybe a place where, a new approach to radio journalism could thrive. And, I don't know. How much money can we get together in the next couple of days?
Right, yeah. So really, it's not the journalist's problem, it's not the consumer's problem or the voter's problem, because they're obviously wanting the good journalism that they feel they deserve. It's really the people that have the money, it's the proprietors, right?
I think there's part of that, and you need proprietors with deep pockets. But on the other hand, if you own a business, you've got a perfect right to make a decent profit at it. And they're just... I think we're in a period now where we really need to rethink how we make money at this. A lot of people, it's been so long in print that there aren't that many people around who forget that what really drove newspapers, what really paid the bills of the newsroom, was classified advertising.
Mm.
It disappeared with Craigslist and Kijiji and any number of online forums. We haven't really yet come up with a good way to replace that. In the community newspaper business, we've got a pretty healthy classified section in our paper, and a lot of small town papers still do.
Mm-hmm.
And display advertising is still doing well. That's, like the big color auto dealer ad or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But those types of ads, the big display ads, never did pay the bills. So we're looking to things like digital. We're looking to things like, if you can get the audience, trying to monetize a podcast. I wish I had the answers. I know that everybody who sort of works in the trenches is doing their damnedest.
Yeah, and people like you need to just continue your work rather than think of this stuff, right? Think about it.
Yeah, it would be nice if we could all do it as a retirement project or something. If someone did once say that journalism now has become sort of that 2-year backpacking trip around Europe you do when you're young before you get serious about life. And, I'd hate to think journalism is going that way, but, with the economics of it, it almost is. It's a younger person's game now, maybe, and...
Is it something that you would suggest for people who are interested in it because they're curious about it, but is it something that you'd suggest that they pursue?
I think so. I think if you've got an interest in it, I think like everything now, you may have to look at making career changes down the road. Mm. But I've never starved doing journalism. And I think you have to go into it realizing it's not the most lucrative thing you may do with your life. Mm-hmm. But also that it's perfectly okay now. I think there has always been this attitude that, you know, journalist isn't a job, it's a calling, it's a lifestyle or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think it's not bad to think about it as something like, I've got an opportunity for 4 or 5 years to do this interesting and important work. And if I do something else afterwards, just don't make it PR, please. you know, then that's okay too. I think we've just, the more young people we're bringing in, the better. Because they always change newsrooms for the good.
Another interesting thing about the part of the world that you live in is how literate and how much a part books are. And I want to touch on this because you serve on the board of the Sunshine Coast Festival
Coast Festival of the Written Arts. We actually talked about changing the name, but that name has so much history attached
to
it.
It's
a mouthful. We call it FOA for short. That's our good acronym.
There you go. When I talk to writers all the time, they consider it one of the great stops in terms of their tours because it's a bucolic place, obviously, but the audiences that attend are certainly some of the best audiences that I mean, I'm familiar with the Writers Fest here in Vancouver, but I mean, on the Sunshine Coast, it's something altogether great, isn't it?
It is a real phenomenon. It's a really engaged audience. Our venue now is where I have to guess. I think we can seat somewhere between 300 and 400 people in our venue. We do one presentation at a time over the course of the weekend, so that helps. I mean, there's only one writer on stage.
Captive audience, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. But, you know, the setting is just amazingly beautiful. It's a heritage building in Seashelt, and we've got the auditorium pavilion beside it, and it's all in a big rhododendron garden, and we always get incredibly fortunate with the weather. And I think it's part of that atmosphere that the writers appreciate, just that everybody is so engaged. The writers are out and mingling with the crowd in the park between things. They're going to each other's events as they do at any festival. So there's that level of intimacy that maybe you can't get at a big city festival where you've got a lot going on all at once. And some people just like the Sunshine Coast. I had the pleasure at last year's festival of introducing Stephen Hyten, a writer from Kingston, Ontario. And we were talking, and he just said, you know, this is the first place I've been in a long time where the drivers actually stopped when I was at the crosswalk, and I almost didn't know what to do with myself. And I spent a lot of time in Kingston, this lovely town, and I always thought it had that same level of genteel respectability, or however you want to describe it. But it's just little things like that that seem to make that festival special. And, you know, of course, we've got an amazing producer and 30 years of history plus behind us. So it's
and the
great.
Extraordinary thing about, because people said that print books were dying 10, 15, 20 years ago. When I talk to people with these various festivals, the numbers just grow and grow and grow year after year, not only in attendance, but sales.
Yeah, and we do on-site book sales. There's an independent book retailer in Seashelt we partner with. And so she and her staff will come in, and they'll have every book by every author on our list that they can find. And at the end of the presentation, the authors will do a little signing and a chit-chat up in the big tent where we also have the book sales going on. And the lineups to buy the books and then get them signed and have a few minutes with the author are just, they're mind-blowing sometimes. You just don't see that anymore.
Yeah. And so you've got a big festival coming up this year, right? It's in August, right?
Yep, August, and here's me trying to remember exactly the dates, but it should be, I think, around the 13th, that weekend. And I'm going to be playing a bigger part than I usually do. I have an event I'll actually be moderating with a couple of authors who've written about wildfires, actually, Edward Struzik and Aaron Williams. Aaron Williams, a lot of people in BC would know because of his book Chasing Smoke about the actual life of a forest firefighter here in BC. And Struzik's book is more around the climate issues that spawn wildfires. So it's going to be a really interesting conversation, and I'm just touching wood that it's not too topical, because I would like to avoid last year's wildfire season if we could.
Indeed, yeah. The other thing that I admire about you, following you on Twitter as I have over the years, is your appreciation of history. I mean, you mentioned a moment ago that's what you got your degree in. But this piece that you're nominated for...
Oh, right. The thing that might win an award, maybe.
Yeah. We were talking on a Saturday afternoon, so we don't know yet what the result
will be. I'll find out in a few hours.
But that's something that I guess you've always wanted to include in your journalism, right? This view of history?
Yeah, and I think we're in a unique position at small community newspapers like this. The award that I'm actually a finalist for is the Neville Shanks Memorial Award for Historical Writing. And Neville Shanks was a journalist and columnist up on the northern part of Vancouver Island. And at a time when all the weekly newspapers would have, like, their local history column. There'd be a
Bill Barley type.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a person who would just sort of write about the history of, you know, that old abandoned house on the edge of town and things like that. And, you know, when you look at the other stories that are nominated in our category, mine is about an archaeological project that the Shishel First Nation's been involved in, where they've made some really incredible finds, and it was turned into an exhibit that opened over the summer at the Canadian Museum of History.
Mm.
They've changed the name a few times, and I keep forgetting. It was the Museum of Man for a while, then the Museum of Civilization, now the Canadian Museum of History. So there's that. Cornelia Naylor from the New Westminster Record wrote a great piece about Susie Chu, founder of Waffle House, if I got the name correct, and just sort of her experiences in Canada. And Jason Schurz from the Powell River Peak wrote about the local Italian club's 80th birthday. And it's all, like, stories like that. It's an incredible privilege to have the time to do them and just sort of show your audience, you know, here's how deep some of the connections in our community go. I mean, in my case, 5,000 years, you know, and Jason's 80 and things like that. But it's something very unique, I think, right now to community papers, where we get this opportunity at a busy newsroom like The Sun in the province, or, you know, even the folks at Metro, who now count as a pretty darn big newsroom. You're chasing those city hall stories all the time, or the cop beat, or the big politics. You don't always have time to tell those stories, and that our editors let us do it is incredible, and it's cool that you can maybe even get an award.
Yeah, and it speaks to, as a reader, I mean, this is the stuff that I like reading, but a lot of people like reading this stuff. Because, I mean, if John Mackey has a piece in The Sun or some historical piece, I mean, I see that on Facebook. How many people share that or talk about that? I mean, this is something that people are wanting.
And it's always new to somebody. I mean, there will be somebody in the audience who knows the history of that you're writing about, or something like that, but there's always a new take, just new people to tell history to. And it's the one, as a historian, I'll put that hat on, take my journalism hat off for just a second, I really get annoyed with people who accuse people of doing revisionist history, because the whole practice of history is to be constantly revising, constantly looking for new evidence, new things to say, new first-hand sources, and new ways to interpret them. And so I like history that evolves. I mean, one of the better books I've read recently, and I don't know if it's been on your list at all, Joe, is Ron Chernow's biography of Ulysses Grant.
Right, yeah.
I don't think this one will convert to a musical quite as well. but it's, I mean, it's Grant is probably one of the more misunderstood U.S. presidents. And, you know, this is just a fascinating piece of history. And you think, what new could you possibly write about Ulysses S. Grant? But Chernow pulls it off. Mm-hmm. And that's the great, you know, even if you're doing history as the basis of journalism or more academic history, you know, to be able to find a little something new and present it to a new audience is just, it's really cool. It's the apex of the job.
Well, I'll wish you luck tonight. By the time this is up on Monday, people will know. Well, they can see on Twitter whether you won or not. But
yeah, I had promised I would tweet the result for some folks back home.
It's been a pleasure meeting you, and I appreciate you coming in to do this, because I find that people do need to talk about the work that they do and how that affects the wider world, and so you've done that, and I appreciate you doing this, and if you're ever in town again, do come by again.
Absolutely. Now, do you have a bust of Grant?
I do. Yeah, I do, actually.
I'll have to have a look at that when we're done.
I'll show you in a bit. It's next to TR there. Yeah. Visit coastreporter.net, and, of course, @SeanEckford is the Twitter handle. Sean Eckford, join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.